UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Welcome. Today we're discussing the management of pediatric patients with intestinal failure. Joining me is Dr. Colin Martin. He's a pediatric surgeon at UAB Medicine. Dr. Martin, it's such a pleasure to have you join us today. Please tell us a little about intestinal failure in children. How common is it? And what are some of the chronic medical management challenges that physicians helping these patients face?
Thank you. Really happy to be here. Pediatric intestinal failure is an increasingly common condition, primarily caused either from acquired conditions at birth or conditions that develop shortly after birth, which include necrotizing enterocolitis, gastroschisis, intestinal midgut volvulus, and intestinal atresias. The problem is patients have a decreased absorptive surface area, and because of that, they have to be on supplemental enteral and or IV nutrition. Some of the chronic problems that these patients face are problems with delivering their IV nutrition, such as line infections or loss of IV access. They also have problems potentially with liver failure, and they have problems with sometimes assimilating to normal activities such as swimming, eating in a lunchroom, things like that.
So then talk about the clinical history findings that are characteristic for other providers that may be working with these children. What would you like them to know are some important red flags for complications?
So there are a lot of complications that happen right when patients develop intestinal failure. But most of the providers, including pediatricians and surgeons, are very well trained in managing the acute things with intestinal failure. So those acute things are managing intra-abdominal sepsis, managing intestinal perforations, managing early nutritional delivery. But some of the more chronic problems that may not be as apparent are poor nutrition or patients having poor bowel habits. And so some of the things that might manifest as poor nutrition are decreased growth. Also, they may have poor dentition, problems with their teeth. They may have poor hair growth on their head. They may also have, when they reach areas of their life that require increased caloric intake, such as puberty, they may have delayed puberty. They also may have neurodevelopmental conditions that all result from poor nutrition.
Dr. Martin, one of the major innovations in the field has been the institution of comprehensive intestinal rehabilitation programs, IRPs. Tell us a little bit about those and what they're intended to do.
Thank you so much. And it's one of the highlights of our program. We're in Birmingham, Alabama, and we're the only intestinal rehab program in the state. And there are a few programs in the Southeast. So there are a lot of patients that don't have the luxury of having multiple care providers seeing them at once. So for example, when we see a patient in our clinic with intestinal failure, they're seeing myself, a pediatric surgeon. Also, they're seeing one of our pediatric gastroenterologists. Dr. David Galloway is the medical director of intestinal rehab program here at University of Alabama at Birmingham. In addition to the two of us, they also see a nutritionist. They see a pharmacist, an occupational therapist, a social worker, a research coordinator, a nurse practitioner, sometimes a chaplain. And so what that means is although the patient visits are longer, these patients are so complex that they can come and see all those care providers at once. But more importantly, the plans that we develop are all very coordinated and are all very linked so that there's not miscommunications or delayed in care because you're having to see multiple people at different times.
such a comprehensive multidisciplinary approach. So tell us about some of the goals of that therapy and some strategies for successful outcomes. Tell us a little how the understanding of each individual is what makes this such a successful type of therapy.
Yeah, these patients are complex, and no one person can be an expert in all those things. For example, I feel very comfortable managing the acute surgical issues. I feel very comfortable managing problems with IV nutrition delivery. But when it comes to things, for example, about occupational therapy guidelines and milestones that children should meet at certain ages, I'm not very educated in that, on that level. So the goal of our intestinal rehab program is to have every child reach their potential. And for some, that, and a lot of our patients, that potential means eventually not requiring IV nutrition to grow and thrive. And so all the nutrition is not given by an IV, but it's taken by mouth or by feeding tube. But that goal may not be realistic for certain patients. Certain patients have such short intestine that they will likely be on IV nutrition either for the rest of their lives, or if they require a small bowel transplant, they may become a transplant candidate. So maximizing each patient's potential. For example, some patients who have a very shortened intestine, they're going to be on IV nutrition for a very long time, but getting to the point where they can be on IV nutrition for 12 or 14 hours per day, it gives them about 12 hours per day or 10 hours per day where they can be free of IV nutrition. They're not harnessed to an IV pump that allows them to go to school, to play sports, and do other things. So each person in our own discipline and expertise, we're trying to push each patient to their maximum potential for success.
How is it different when you're dealing with infants versus a little bit of an older child?
For infants, it's interesting because in terms of this, asking them symptoms and how they're doing, we have to rely on the parents and the caregivers, and also rely on more objective factors like their weight gain, their weight loss, looking at their laboratory values. As kids get older, particularly as it relates to delivering nutrition and being sure that we don't deliver more nutrition than their intestine can handle, the conversation shifts. So we sort of talk about, well, we know you like to eat potato chips and juice, but that's not very good for your intestine. If you were to eat more balanced meals, then you may do well and not require IV nutrition. Another example is when children are at school, sometimes when they have bowel movements, they're very foul smelling and can be loose and can be associated with a lot of gas. And so because of those things, children who are school age are less likely to want to use the bathroom to have a bowel movement while at school. And so therefore, they're less likely to eat because shortly after eating, they have a bowel movement. And so readjusting their thought process and their expectations and understanding their concerns allows us to make changes and taking the kids' input into what's going on allows us to make changes to give them a better outcome.
That is so interesting, and what a good point, Dr. Martin. So how have your outcomes been? What have you been seeing as a result of this collaborative effort?
The things that we are looking at, some of them have been great, and some of them are areas of improvement. We've been good about identifying vitamin and nutrient deficiencies, and so this is work really spearheaded by Dr. Galloway, who's the pediatric gastroenterologist here at UAB in Children's Hospital of Alabama. And so we're able to screen patients for these micronutrient deficiencies, things like zinc and copper and vitamin D, and we've been able to really increase or decrease the amount of patients that have deficiencies in those areas. Another thing that we've done that's been a great improvement is we've had an increase in the amount of patients that take the flu shot, the flu vaccine. Patients with intestinal failure who contract the flu, their outcomes and their ability to really rebound and respond are much, much worse compared to patients who don't have intestinal failure. So our flu vaccine rate is way up. Another way that we've increased is we've had a better way that we deliver care to families despite their background, their understanding, or education. Some of these diagnoses and treatment strategies are really difficult and hard to understand for anyone. And we've done some research, and we've been able to understand how we deliver our information, and we want to deliver it on a level that the caregiver can understand very clearly. So we've done some changes there. One area that we've identified for improvement is the rate of central venous line infections. The central venous line is the way IV nutrition is delivered. And we've identified that our central venous line infection rate is higher than other reported centers. And so by identifying that, we've done it in such a way, a very granular way, that we're now looking at things that contribute to a high infectious central venous line infection rate and ways to decrease it.
As we wrap up, Dr. Martin, what are some future surgical interventions, such as bowel lengthening procedures, that show promise? Tell us about some of the other things that you have in the arsenal that might be used in the management and strategy of children with intestinal failure.
Yeah, I think three things that come to mind. The first one, as you mentioned, is bowel lengthening. So it's not a new strategy. In the 1990s, one of our surgeons in Boston developed a bowel lengthening procedure called a serial transverse enteroplasty. Basically, it's taking a dilated loop of intestine, and through a series of staple fires, we're able to increase the length of the intestine, increase the absorptive surface area, and increase or improve motility. And in selected patients, we found that has been very helpful in a lot of our patient populations. The other area of research in the future, and we've started to do this some at our research center, a research paper that's close to publication from our center. We looked at changes in the intestinal microbiome patients with intestinal failure. And so we found that patients who have more complications and poor growth tend to have a signature microbiome. And the corollary is the same. Patients who do better have also a distinctive microbiome. And so in the future, our study and others are looking at innovative ways to think about doing fecal or microbiome transplants, sort of taking a good bacteria from a patient that does well and transplanting that into a patient that has worse outcomes. And the third thing is intestinal transplantation. We haven't talked about that much. At our center, we don't do intestinal transplantation. It's a very difficult, resource-intensive, but at times very successful program. And so we send our patients out to a few centers around the country for intestinal transplantation. And outcomes for intestinal transplantation have improved. And as anti-rejection medications improve, surgical techniques improve along the lines of intestinal transplantation, that will also be a viable option for certain patients.
Absolutely fascinating. Do you have any final thoughts for other providers about referral to UAB Medicine and what you want them to know about pediatric intestinal failure?
Well, the first thing is that this is a very collaborative effort. The amount of patients with intestinal failure is so much shorter than patients with other diagnoses such as cystic fibrosis or leukemia. And so we have a relatively small patient population. And so we're very open as a center to offer our expertise and see patients at any point. This can be virtually via chart review or in person. But also, very importantly, we're very, very open to learn from other centers. And so if there are techniques that other centers are doing or experiences that we aren't doing here, we're very open to have a two-way communication of learning seeing other ways that things can be done. We can definitely be found on our website. We have an intestinal rehab website at the UAB.com website. And we're just looking forward to continued success both at our center and for other centers across the nation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Martin, for really sharing your incredible expertise in this very interesting topic. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. And that concludes this episode of the UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, please visit our website at uabmedicine.org/physician. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast and all the other UAB podcasts. For more health tips and updates on the latest medical advancements and breakthroughs, follow us on your social channels. I'm Melanie Cole.